TNT Radio wants you to get on our soapbox because your opinion matters. Tell us what you really think at tntradio.live. Upload a video, some audio, or drop us a note on TNT Radio's soapbox, lighting the fuse for freedom. Today's news talk, TNT Radio. You're listening to George Eliason, live from Donbas, Ukraine, on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome to the show today. I'm George Eliason. Big news, and it's breaking, is Ukraine struck the Druzhba pipeline with a Tochka-U missile. And this pipeline pumps more than 33 gallons of oil per hour into Europe. So Europe gets to suffer while they support Ukraine, which is, I guess it's good news. I mean, share the suffering even more. I guess attacking Nord Stream wasn't enough. So now, instead of just not getting the gas, they're losing the oil and losing the more of their industry. This is what we have to put up with until we actually have a change out of governments all over the place. Ukraine is set on spreading the suffering, and this is just it. Now, if you listen to the Mike Ryan show this morning, we talked about Ukraine harvesting children's organs, and they're finding facilities. What the Russians are finding facilities when they take areas. And this was up at Izium. It's very unfortunate. And the thing about this is, if it's brand new to you, the easiest thing to do is sit there like a deer caught in the headlights in shock for a minute. But this has been going on for 9 years, 9 long years. And that moment where you get to sit with a deer, like a deer in the headlights in shock, needs to be short, because these children are being murdered. And the Ukrainians they caught said that, yeah, it was like farm animals. That's how they looked at them. That's how they treated them. Farm animals to the slaughter. Now, Mike also asked me about an ex-UK parliamentarian encouraging the UK to put boots on the ground to end the war. And that, in part, was what I think this missile strike on the pipeline is about. If Russia steps up an awful lot, all the signs are there from Germany, from everybody sending these tanks, sending the planes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. These countries are already involved in the war. And stepping up like they are is the absolute worst thing that can happen in your home country. Now, okay, that just sounds okay. That's just redundant. So, okay, what? Effectively declaring war on Russia and then making the war impossible to end because you just keep backing it up until the last Ukrainian. You're in the war. Now, it gets a little tricky. Ukraine is not an existential threat against Russia, but what would be? If the parliamentarian gets his way to put boots on the ground to end a war? Mike Ryan asked me what I thought about that. And I said, well, you know, the truth is, I don't know what the Russians think. They certainly don't call me for advice, because if I was in the Kremlin and that happened, it would take 3 seconds for my fingers to hit that button. It just, you know, for me, it's just the way I operate. You want to play hardball? Let's escalate. You want to escalate? I'll show you what it means. Let's get right there, because that's where we're going anyway. So let's get it over with. The UK, Poland, all these countries, want to push Russia to that point. And that's why I said that. They're doing everything they can to push Russia to that point. Will Russia drop a nuke on Ukraine? The answer is, again, I'm not in the Kremlin, but 99% hell no. The reason they've been going so slow is to save lives. And why would you destroy them? It's Ukraine that's doing that. If you've seen any of the conscription videos that are floating around, and I suggest you look for them. Now, these aren't draft dodgers. A lot of these people were either opted out or were already in the war, did their service. They're running out of guys. They're grabbing them. Ukraine was denying that they were going to foreign countries and saying, send the men of draft age back. But that's what they're doing. It's confirmed. It's unfortunate you can't believe anything coming out of Ukraine or from people that support Ukraine because they get their news from Ukraine. It is makes it very, very limiting. And so the thing is, we got to try to keep the news straight, but it's often so over the top. And honestly, it works to Ukraine's benefits because people don't want to hear about, I'm not going to call it a tragedy with the children. It's a horror. It's been going on, men, women, and children. Ukraine is one of the largest dealers in the illegal organ trade, has been for 20 years. And they signed a law, and I talked about it this morning with Mike, that their soldiers on the front lines, they don't even need to give permission. They're automatically optioned for organ donations. And let me tell you something. You cannot do that after someone's died already. They have to be alive when they take the organs. Now, you can follow that thread from there. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll have Dede Denslow. Before we do, I just wanted to remind you, you don't need to miss out on a thing at TNT. Be sure to download the TNT radio app from either the Apple App Store or Google Play so you can easily listen live to us anywhere, anytime. It's available right now to download, keeping you up to speed on TNT radio.
News and talk you can count on.
I can rely on them.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back, and we've got TNT producer and host Dede Denslow in the house this afternoon. And the headline reads, White House Reveals COVID Emergency Plan. Dede, what's going on with this?
Hi, George. Glad you're back on air. I was just listening to your opening monologue about the organ donations or forced organ donations in Ukraine. It's disgusting. It's information I've just come across. And it almost makes me feel guilty to be talking about COVID again. Yeah, the US president responded to a push in Congress by offering an expiration date to the COVID emergency plan. The White House announced on Monday that it wants to end the COVID-19 national emergency by May the 11th, though that would entail extending it first. The plan comes after Republicans in the House of Representatives announced a vote on ending the emergency, and as the World Health Organization said, the public health restrictions ought to continue in some form. The current national emergency declaration is set to expire on March the 1st, while the public health emergency runs out on April the 11th. President Joe Biden intends to extend the emergency declarations to May the 11th and then end both emergencies on that date. The Office of Management and Budget said in a statement quoted by multiple outlets, too late. Republicans already announced we're declaring COVID is over and passing it through the House this week. Congressman Marjorie Taylor Greene, a Georgian Republican, tweeted in response, the GOP is leading on this issue and Biden is trying to take the credit. Meanwhile, the WHO published the conclusions of its emergency committee from a meeting held on Friday, which said the pandemic continues to constitute a public health emergency of international concern. WHO Director General Tedros, I'm not going to say the rest of his name, I can't pronounce it, agreed with the committee that the pandemic is probably at a transition point and endorsed their recommendations for alternative mechanisms to maintain the global and national focus on the disease after the emergency ends. The advisory body also urged the WHO and member states to maintain multiple component surveillance systems and continue pushing for vaccination to the point of including it in life course immunization schedules. And I think those last two statements that came out advisory body who was talking to WHO saying that surveillance systems and life course immunizations and vaccines, that seems to be why I would suggest why this emergency has been declared, has been extended in the USA. If we was to investigate a lot of the other Western countries, we'd find that their emergency measures are still quietly in place. Also, is this just because they've got large stockpiles of vaccinations that they need to get rid of, or because they have no intention of dropping these emergency measures and they're just going to keep kicking this can down the road as part of their mission creep, George?
Yeah, I think so too. And I agree with you 100%. Anytime there's an election, okay, kick up the COVID mandate again. You know, if there's an actual medical emergency, how can you pick a date to end it? That's the first big question I have. The second is if the groups that you're relying on for information about COVID are saying it's still ongoing. Okay, now we're back to the first question. How can you pick a date?
They did that right through the pandemic. And it's a point, that first point, and I'm sorry to interrupt you because it's so important, that point, that it just sort of whips over people's minds that actually COVID is able to pick start and finish dates. Oh, we need mask mm-hmm. mandates in a month's time. Why? Has COVID told you that it's coming back in a month's time, or it's going to be a serious problem in a month's time? And they picked these dates right through the last 3 years, and they still seem to be doing it by saying we need to keep this emergency in place in the USA until May 11th, because COVID's already told us that it's going to be, you know, leaving for its summer holidays then, which is what you're suggesting. And it just shows what a farce the whole situation is, George.
Well, when we had that Pfizer exec on, talking to him, and he openly said, no, it's no better, no worse than any other flu. You know, the whole thing's political. Okay, so here we have Pfizer vaccine, saying, here it is. It's a flu. So, you know, the whole thing is a game. It's a political game. It's about control. It's about seeing how far they can push. And, you know, I think what it is Joe might be planning a vacation, or whoever's responsible for setting the date of the new, I don't know, the new brand of COVID is taking a vacation. I don't know. But this, you know, beyond being wrong and dangerous, it's how much is this hurting people around the world? It's just crazy.
And on top of that, George, in my country, in Australia, I believe in Canada, and in the USA, I can't be certain on the USA, but in the first four, which were all part of the Five Eyes, they've all given contracts to Moderna to start producing millions upon millions of doses of vaccines, unspecified vaccines. Do you think that this is being put in place because they know that there might be another pandemic, using radio quotes there, another pandemic coming in the near future?
Well, they've probably got the new strain, you know, perfected, so, or close to it, so they're ready. Yeah, so be ready.
Oh, I think if anything, what's taught us over the last few years is that we need to prepare and be ready for the future. And that means self-reliance and self-dependence, not preparing with your your sort of safety net very much aligned with the government. And there is one final part of this article. The Biden administration had tried to impose the shots first to government employees and then to the private sector, but U.S. courts have overruled most of the mandates for vaccines as unconstitutional. Biden campaigned on 2020 on a promise to shut down the virus. As of Monday, the total number of U.S. deaths attributed to COVID-19 stood at 1.1 million people, up from 400,000 when he took over. So let's just say they are COVID deaths. We know that they're not. Biden has done a terrible job of mitigating the risk from the pandemic and stop people from dying. Do you think that Biden's future now, will he make it to the end of his 4 years, or will they slowly and very quiet, not necessarily quietly, but will they slowly before then get him out of the way so that he doesn't run again, and two, they might have an incumbent that might be able to challenge for the premier job in the USA starting in 2025 when they finally take office?
Well, I think that, you know, with Biden, you've got enough Republicans that want to recall and impeach. They actually have a case for Article 25 because he's just not there mentally. But the big fear is that Kamala Harris would do a lot more damage. So in terms of him finishing his term, unless he does something really, really stupid, or old age just gets the best of him, I think we're stuck with Biden.
You think Biden's going to see it through to the end of his term? All I can say is God help us all if that is the case. And my prediction then, George, and we can have this conversation again in a year's time, is that he won't make it to the end of his term. There will be some reason for them the Democrats or the Republicans to have to remove him from power, because he is a liability, and the Democrats are in general, to say the least, George.
I'll agree with your assessment of him 100%. Let's see what happens. Dede Denslow, thank you so much for coming by today, and we'll see you tomorrow with the next news item.
See you tomorrow, George, and I'll definitely make sure it's non-COVID related, because I think we're all getting sick to the back teeth of it now. See you tomorrow, George.
All right, Dede. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we've got John Helmer coming on, and we're going to talk about some really deep stuff that he's working on. We'll see you in a minute. This is TNT Talk Radio.
TNT Radio's Steve Malzberg.
What was the straw that broke the back, if you will, that led the Catholic League to say, we really have to do a documentary and expose what Disney has become?
Any good, honest, hardworking American would agree with this notion that children in kindergarten through third grade should not be lectured on, should not be, frankly, indoctrinated by the agenda of transgenderism, the whole woke transgender ideology. That is no place in kindergarten. They shouldn't be learning about sexual orientation, gender identity. And then suddenly Disney decides to weigh into that and say, you know what, actually, we've got a lot of employees here that are upset that you can't groom the kids anymore. So we're going to do everything in our power to repeal this law, go after the lawmakers that are trying to protect the kids, because that's what the woke priests at Disney want to see these days.
Steve Malzberg on TNT Radio.
Wokeness is infiltrating churches, and people don't really know what's hitting them.
Critical race theory assumes that racism is everywhere, it is in everything. These ideologies have crept into the church.
I have grown up with this invisible kind of bag of privilege.
And I know, as a white pastor, I have blind spots.
Reparations fits into the scope of the gospel.
It's a racist worldview. You're swimming in racism.
The social justice warriors say, if you're white, you are racist. And if you say that you are not a racist, then you have to be a white supremacist.
I see within evangelicalism today an attack on the very gospel itself.
Social justice doesn't have to do with justice, it has to do with Marxism.
Wokeness is now the dominant academic paradigm on many university and college campuses.
Many of our Christian universities have fallen prey.
I went to an all-black school, raised in a black context. Everything was oppression. White people are racist, cops can't be trusted, and this world is not for us, it's against us. We felt like the government owed us. I have a family, I have children, and I don't have a job. I was just, it was at the darkest point in my life.
Because I was white, would we have to divorce and separate due to my skin color?
Christianity enables people to find forgiveness and redemption. However, Marxism is completely vindictive.
There is no redeemer and there is no redemption in the religion of anti-racism.
I believe that the evangelical church today is going to have to make a decision. Are we going to submit to the culture, or are we going to remain true to the faith and take the consequences?
How the left is stealing your church. The invasion of the gospel of woke at salemnow.com.
The left want to control what people say and think. Lighting the fuse for freedom, TNT Radio.
Welcome back. And we've got one of the absolute best journalists and Russia specialists in the world with us today, John Helmer. Now, if you're not familiar with his work, John's an Australian who graduated in political science from Harvard University, worked in the White House as an aide to President Jimmy Carter. He's also the longest continuously serving foreign correspondent in Russia and the only Western journalist to direct his own bureau independent of single national or commercial ties. He first set up the bureau in 89, making him today the doyen of the foreign press corps in Russia. He's also been a professor of political science, sociology, and journalism, and an advisor to government heads in Australia, Greece, the US, and Sri Lanka. He's a regular presenter on Russian topics in China, Western Europe, and the US at conferences. And you can just go on and on and on. He is one of, if not the most widely read Russia specialist in the business world today. John, welcome. Oh, one more thing first. Hold it. He has a new book out, Australian Fascism, How It Destroyed the Courts, available in paperback at Amazon and where good books are sold. Okay, John, how are you? Welcome to the show.
I'm fine. Thank you, George. Thank you for having me.
You have some really, really timely articles out. And quite frankly, you're really hitting the numbers on this. Let's see, Vladimir Kutz, Long Distance Effect, Sanctions and Geography are Replacing the Russian Oligarchy with State Planning, Producing a Better Growth Rate than the U.S. and Germany. And you're talking about the IRS, what the IMF is reporting, and it's a jaw-dropper. Can you tell us about this?
Well, perhaps before we start on the IMF, because that's a big surprise, as you say, George, let me begin by saying that the preceding article focused on something the Western press and the alternative media in the U.S. have also failed to notice, and that's Maria Zakharova, the foreign ministry spokesman in Moscow, her statement. A lengthy statement in her weekly briefing on Friday. And in that statement, Zakharova set out the fundamental change in Russian strategic and tactical thinking towards Germany in what it was an extremely personal attack on the Germans and on Schulz and his ministers in Berlin for reviving and repeating the German strategy to destroy Russia. I say personal because Zakharova referred to her grandmother's experience during World War II. All Russians have a family member affected, and I do too. Nobody should imagine, but this is the part that's left out of Western coverage, that Russians forget what the Germans did to Russia between 39 and 45. And what a Russian tank means, a Leopard tank now, German tanks before, means to Russians. There will be a very, very long and sustained and consistent reaction and response to the Germans. And as German generals have warned in the previous weeks, what defense does Germany have when it engages in war against Russia on the Ukrainian battlefield, when that battle is lost? Can Germany defend itself again, short of nuclear warfare? A nuclear war would destroy Germany. Those are the issues that Zakharova raised for some reason that's beyond my understanding. Neither the mainstream media nor the alt media have identified it or quoted from it. This is a fundamental change, and because it's so personal, it has a dramatic effect that shouldn't be underestimated. Now, that's a surprise. The second surprise you began with, George, and I was.
Well, hold on. Let's stay with this for a second. I wanted to talk about it after the first article I mentioned. Now, you can find the article at danceswithbears.com, and the title is Russian Foreign Ministry Rejects Blinken and Nuland Proposals, Condemns Scholz for Reviving Hitler's Plan to Destroy Russia. And what you're saying is absolutely correct. And she actually said, if she was saying this on a personal level, not a professional level, she would have used a lot harsher language.
Yes, she said that.
Now, this, you know, just the concept of this, and even in Ukraine, what do you think these Ukrainians that don't support Zelensky's regime, what he's done, what he's been doing, what this nationalism, knowing where it stems from, having to reject their grandparents' sacrifices in World War II, and on top of that, seeing these tanks roll up through to the front lines. I mean, it's a horror show. Just all the way across.
George. It is indeed, George, and you in the Donbass can speak directly to that better than I can. I guess the short answer to your question is that we've reached the point where, in terms of Russian strategy, in terms of the proposed strategy from the Western side, the future for Zelensky and the current civilian regime in Kiev is short. And the question that was raised in the previous week of how long the U.S. will continue to support the Zelensky regime if and when Russian general offensive gears up, and if and when it's accepted and understood on the battlefield and in the political capitals abroad that the Ukraine war has been lost, that at that point the Zelensky regime could be expected to be replaced by a Ukrainian military junta, and that the Ukrainian generals, some of whom have been talking to the Western press for the future, some of whom have not, will replace the civilians. The big questions that remain, as you rightly said, George, what can Ukrainian people think will be decided on the battlefield in the coming weeks and months? But the future for Zelensky is about as bright as the future of the South Vietnamese regime was from the assassination of President Diem to his replacement by a succession of South Vietnamese army generals, each of whom ended up in exile in the United States. But compared to Diem, their war ended with themselves dying in bed. The question of how far the Ukrainian oligarchy, the Ukrainian elite, can continue to support Zelensky's regime in a losing war, that question is yet to be settled.
Now, here's another question about this, because, you know, it's obvious that everybody in Europe understands the optics on this full well before they actually brought it up. The idea of these German tanks with their little crosses on it barreling across Ukraine towards Russia again. I mean, this is it's like, you know, taking, I don't know, half of Israel, if you could fit them into Auschwitz, and firing up the ovens again, saying, hey, guys, have a look. What do you think? Go inside. I mean, it's, they understand this, these optics, and they're very systematically trying to push the buttons for escalation. And is it to bring NATO actually in, or is it to get Putin to attack Europe first? What do you think is the thought behind this?
Well, that's a question for the West. It's a question for the NATO command. From the view, and I'm not the expert to ask about that, George, but it's a good question. And the question I'd try to answer this way. There's a promise of German Leopard tanks to be delivered. There's a promise of U.S. tanks to be delivered, the Abrams, the M1 Abrams tank. There's a promise of the British Challenger tank to be delivered. And maybe the French will throw in a few Leclerc tanks. How many tanks add up from promises to actual delivery is one question. Russians are military correspondents, and everything I'm saying, I'm not on the battlefield. You're closer to the front than I am. I'm simply close to the way in which the country and the politics I've been reporting for more than 30 years. That's my closeness. On the basis of what the Russian front reports show, there may be anywhere from 150 to 350 tanks to be supplied to the Ukraine over the next 6 months. Now, how will they be used? Will they roll across Ukrainian territory into the Donbas? Will they roll? Are they aimed to cut the land bridge and attack Crimea? Are they aimed to cross the Russian border? Well, that's a tactical question, it's a strategic question, and the Ukrainians aren't exactly, neither the NATO command, free to answer it without first having to cope with the Russian offensive. For the time being, tanks are used in the Ukraine war as self-propelled artillery. They fire and they run away. They run away in order to avoid counterfire from Russian artillery batteries. Essentially, the tanks are mobile artillery used with civilian cover inside cities and so forth to attack Ukrainian Donbas Russian targets. They're not used as an offensive. The Ukrainian military and the Western press supporting them unanimously propose the tanks as a new Ukrainian offensive to, quote, take back Crimea, take back the cities of the Donbas, of the four new regions of Russia. Now, to do either of those things, between 150 and 350 new tanks have to be brought into the country across the Polish border, where they're immediately exposed to Russian air, missile, and drone attack. They then have to be stored, based, supplied, maintained by large numbers of men, Polish soldiers, NATO soldiers and technicians, Americans, British, and so on, in bases as close to the fighting front the tanks are intended to be used for. That might be Chernigov, it might be Vinnytsia, it might be Dnipropetrovsk, it might be Poltava. All of those locations are the locations in which you can use tanks either as mobile artillery or as offensive weapons. Whichever the decision is made to do will take time and men, and not just Ukrainian army people. They will be foreign forces on the ground, including Germans. When that happens, if that happens, the Russian side, the general staff, have between now and then a decision to make. Will they be struck as they come across the border in the west of Kyiv, between, let's say, Lvov and Kyiv, along the line, north-south line around Vinnytsia? Will they be, can they move, if they're heavy vehicles, across the light bridges into firing positions along the Donbass line of contact? If so, when will they be struck? What is Russian strategy? To draw them in and then destroy them? These are questions I don't answer, because if I did know the answers, I wouldn't be talking about them right now. Second, I don't know the answers.
Now, when we switch over to the IMF story in a minute, we're going to take a break. I was wondering if you'd heard about the Druzhya pipeline hit.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear. Which pipeline happened. Are we talking about?
The Druzhba.
Ah.
There's two lines,
yes.
One's north. Ukraine hit it with a Tochka U and took out a section. And that's a big story. It actually plays into what you'll be talking about with the IMF, because this is going to affect the gross domestic product of a lot of countries. We'll get to it when we get back. I'm George Eliason. We have John Helmer with us today. We'll see you in a few minutes.
With his expert analysis and opinion, this is TNT Radio's Timothy Shea.
I was reminded again today that not everyone has had the same background as I, and that things that I take for granted as being common knowledge oftentimes aren't. So too with the use of cis and trans to describe gender. The conversation arose from my Facebook post, Get It Straight. I'm straight, not cis. And people quickly started saying, I don't even know what that means. Where did that come from? Well, it comes from chemistry, where two different molecules might have the same chemical formula, but they have different spatial arrangements of their atoms and might even have different chemical properties as a result. I'll spare you the chemistry. You can look it up yourself. Just look on Wikipedia for cis trans isomerism. The point is that cis and trans come from Latin and mean this side of and the other side of. Has nothing to do with gender. It's just a misappropriation from people with a political agenda and some severe mental illnesses. From MAGAInstitute.com, this is Timothy Shea for TNT Radio.
Challenging the consensus and debunking the narrative. This is Viewpoint.
Who is Klaus Schwab and what is the World Economic Forum which he leads? Just quoting Klaus Schwab is alarming enough. If he and his billionaire friends achieve their Great Reset, tyranny would be the new world order. Born in Ravensburg, Germany in 1938, Klaus Schwab is a child of Adolf Hitler's Third Reich, a political state regime built on fear and violence, on brainwashing and control, on propaganda and lies. While the Nazis desired a new order for Germany that would last 1,000 years, Klaus Schwab's vision extends globally and would potentially be unstoppable were nations to relinquish all sovereignty and adopt the neurotechnologies and biotechnologies which forces us, in the words of Klaus Schwab, to question what it means to be human.
Now I want to say this, and I'm going to say it just once.
This is today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
We've got Russia specialist and journalist John Helmer with us today, and we're talking all things Ukraine. Now, this next article that we're going to get into, where you're talking about the IMF, this is also at Dances with Bears. The Vladimir Coutts' long-distance effects, sanctions and geography are replacing the Russian oligarchy with state planning, producing a better growth rate than the U.S. and Germany. Tell us what's going on here, because this is wild and exciting. I mean, you know, who'd have thunk it?
It's exciting to U.S. readers, to me, for this reason, George. It's not normal for the International Monetary Fund, which is an international bank dominated on its board by the United States and by the NATO allies. It's not normal for the chief economist of the IMF to produce an official report, an update on the prospects for the world economy in 2023 to 2024-5. It's not normal for the IMF to admit that Russia's growth rate over the next 2 years will exceed the US, the Germans, the French, and the British, and the Japanese. It's an admission by the IMF that the entire economic division of the US-NATO war against Russia is lost. It's failing. That's the first point. The second point is that the Russian recovery from last year's 2.2% GDP growth rate loss, the Russian recovery is moving faster than the allied economies are capable of sustaining for themselves. That means, relatively speaking, the allies' economies are doing worse than the Russian one. That's another way of saying the war's being lost in Europe. The third point is the numbers. The numbers I've just indicated appear in a table, page 6 of the report. Not a single Western newspaper, mainstream medium, until you came along, George, not a single radio station in the United States has noticed what the IMF is saying. Now, I've just summarized disclosed but unreported about the relative performance of the Russian economy versus the economies of the countries at war with Russia. The second part is that domestically what's happening as a result of sanctions war is that the Russian economy must mobilize, coordinate, decide and plan according to entirely different principles than have been applied since 1991. The oligarch system, in which individual ownership of the major industries, the major export producing industries of Russia, oil and coal are mentioned in the article, must no longer be directed by profit-seeking oligarchs exporting their profit abroad. The Russian oligarchy is being liquidated by the combination of US-NATO sanctions and the exigencies of war. And that's also indicated in the article. In other words, the war is forcing a kind of revolution in Russian economic direction domestically. That's not something that's so easy to discuss in the Russian domestic press, but it's obvious. And the article of today that you referred to, George, explains in Russian terms what's happening as the oil oligarchs and the coal oligarchs compete for scarce space on the Russian railroads that move these commodities to the east in order to be exported to the friendly countries, China and India principally, because the US and the NATO allies have cut off Russian oil and coal exports to Europe. They're achieving, the allies that's to say, a revolution in Russian domestic economic policy, but it's not the one they intended.
Right. And long term, this is, you know, when I say exciting, you know, I guess I'm echoing what you're talking about. Russia would not have done this had these things not happened.
Correct.
That this revolutionary process, it provides long-term growth. Am I right in thinking that? Long-term stability, growth, and prosperity for Russia over, I mean, what are you looking at? 10, 20 years, the way, you know, if they set it up right?
That's right. Let me get back to the point you made, which readers might and listeners might find difficult to understand. Why is this article called the Vladimir Kutz effect? Kutz is spelled K-U-T-S. Mm-hmm. This is the reason, George. I was a little boy in 1956 when the Olympic Games were performed in Melbourne, Australia. And I remember watching from the stands Vladimir Kutz winning the 5,000 and 10,000 meter long distance races. At that time, late 1956, Hungary had been invaded. The Budapest Rebellion and the bloody repression of Hungary was very well known, as had been the Allied attack, the Israel, British and French attack on Egypt earlier in that year. Mm-hmm. So the stands were full of people howling against this stocky little guy, Vladimir Kutz, who ran these races from the front, from beginning to end, and defeated, at that time, the principal runners-up were Hungarian and British. So you can imagine what a little boy watching this little guy run this race was thinking as everybody around him was cheering for the Hungarians and for the British. This guy, Kutz, ran long distance races, both of them, from the front, from beginning to end. And I thought to myself, and this is the part I remember, and this is the part I've applied as an example for today. A small, unassuming, unathletic-looking man runs a long-distance race, conserving his resources, running from the front, and winning at the end. The way in which an athlete runs a 5,000 or 10,000-meter race is, metaphorically speaking, to a little boy, an inspiration of how one runs life, how one runs politics. And this is where we are now. We are at, regrettably, sadly, softly to speak, in a war of the worlds in which Russia has been attacked by all of the European powers, now Germany, France, and Britain, on the Ukrainian battlefield, and it has a long war to fight still. The Kutz effect is not to be underestimated. It should be understood as the way Russians learn from their mistakes quicker than their adversaries and learn to fight long wars. What the IMF is saying today, or on Monday, this week, is that the Russian performance for long distance war fighting in Europe, the Russian performance is better than and will succeed better than the US and NATO allies. Now, that's a surprise. That's how we began this program, George. That's mm-hmm. how this is the takeaway for listeners. These are two surprises, the military one we've spoken of, the Leopard tank that's a paper tiger, that's a surprise, not in the Western press, not in the alt media press, but even more surprising in the long-term run for the Russian economy, this war can be a victory on the economic front for Russian people, and that includes the four new states in the Donbass.
No, exactly. And it just, when I saw this, I was just simply shocked. If, you know, in my reasoning wasn't as developed as yours, obviously. But it's just looking at it at face value is just crazy. And you forgot to mention Canada, 29% better than Canada just because Chrystia Freeland lives there, it's good enough for me.
Well, it now, there was a speak to the Canadian audience here, George. You're right. Canada it represents state capture by the not just the Ukrainians, not even the Ukrainians. State capture by the Galicians, the West Ukrainian mm-hmm. region, which was occupied by the German army, and which has long harbored the desire to destroy Russia, just as the Galicians destroyed the Jews and the Poles, as well as Russians, during World War II. Chrystia Freeland, Deputy Prime Minister of Canada, is the direct descendant from her grandfather, Michael Chermiak, from the Ukrainian murder gangs of Galicia around Lvov, between Lvov and Krakow, from World War II. She has mm-hmm. represented the Canadian intention to fight to the destruction of Russia, as Chomiak aimed on behalf of the German army to do between 39 and 45. And he got rich at that. He got rich. He got rich by stealing the property, the apartment, the car, and the printing press of a Jewish family whom he knew to have been murdered in a concentration camp. This is, imagine, the deputy prime minister of a country whose grandfather profited from the murder of Jews. I mean, it's stunning, but that's state capture. Canada has been captured by those Ukrainians and also by the Canadian military staffs, the general staffs of Canada, mm-hmm. well trained by the United States, and moved into position in Lvov at the moment, on the Polish side of the border at the moment, and closer to the front at the moment. The Canadian general staff have also profited from this war, as the Chermiak-Freeland coalition have profited. And so, yes, this is what Canada is doing in this war. And yes, the IMF shows that the Canadian people, Black, Indigenous, First Nation, and white Canadians are losing in this mm-hmm. economic war against Russia. They're paying for the Freeland and the general staff to go to war, and they're losing as a result of it.
Now, I want to add one thing to that. If you go back to the 1980s, the CBC, which is like the BBC but in Canada, actually reported on this, that these Galicians were trying to take over the government. They were working at it, and if something wasn't done, they would succeed. Fast forward to 2022, they're saying, what Nazis? We don't know about that. We don't know any about that. We don't know a thing about that. And that's just how crazy it is. We've got about 3 minutes left, John. So please pick up. First of all, I want to remind everybody about your book again. Okay. This is important. It's called Australian Fascism, How It Destroyed the Courts, and it's in paperback at Amazon and fine bookstores. All right. 3 minutes left. Where do you want to go from here? What do you think? Is there any way that Europe can walk back on any of this at this point?
Well, there are ways. There are democratic ways. There are political ways, George. Yes, for listeners who are in England, in France, in Germany, Italy, yes, they can hope to make a political impact domestically. In Germany, the domestic impact pretty much lost. But you began this section of the program, George, by referring to today's rocket attack on the Druzhba pipeline at a terminal in Russia. What's that? Let's point this out, that the Druzhba pipeline delivers oil to Hungary and Slovakia, and Hungary is directly affected by any interruption of the Druzhba oil pipeline. There have been a couple last year. that were technical, not military in nature. This one appears to be either a sabotage or a rocket attack, and it's clearly of the same kind as the demolition of the Nord Stream undersea pipelines, which were an attack on Germany. Now, Hungary has a significantly different assessment of the damage of this war and is resisting this war. So Hungarians can get out in the morning and understand their oil has been cut off by a Ukrainian attack. Hungarians right now are already protesting against the deployment of their ethnic Hungarian brothers from Transcarpathia on the front, where they're exposed to higher casualties than other ethnic Ukrainians. Hungary has a different approach.
So the answer to
your quick question, George, is the Hungarians know how to resist. Let's see if the rest of Europe does.
And yeah, let's do that. John Helmer, thank you so much for coming on today.